Hello, and welcome to a special episode of Sheldrake on Shakespeare, an interview with Robert Price. Robert was for 8 years the senior voice tutor at RADA, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, and was also a voice tutor at LAMDA, the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art, two of Britain's, indeed the world's, leading drama schools. Robert and I met some years ago when I ran a workshop on Shakespeare's history plays at RADA, and I recalled him being very good company and having interesting things to say. So as part of my return to a more literary and creative line of work, it seemed a good way of reconnecting with him to invite him onto the podcast. He has now left voice teaching to work in voice therapy, but I'm glad to say he was still very keen to talk about Shakespeare and the voice. So I went over to his practice in Soho and recorded the interview you are about to hear. I hope you enjoy listening to it as much as I enjoyed speaking to him. Robert Price, thank you for making the time.
It's a huge pleasure. Looking forward to our conversation.
So am I. We'll come on to your professional work in a minute, but I wonder if we can start with your own experiences with Shakespeare. Did you kind of meet him at school and find him immediately magnetic, or was it a kind of slower burn than that?
I recall doing Macbeth at school and sort of getting it. And I think by nature I'm kind of curious about things that are supposed to be good. So I made some attempt, I think, to understand it. I don't think I was hugely taken, probably until I remember seeing a production. I went to university to study law, and in 1987 or 1988, there was a company called Not the National Theatre, which I don't really know much about, but they were quite sort of highly regarded and quite successful, and they were clearly angry with the National Theatre for some reason. So their symbol was called an NT with a great big slash through it. And they came to the University of Wales, Aberystwyth, where I was studying, and they did a Pinter, The Caretaker, and a production of Othello. And I hadn't I'd ever seen a play by Harold Pinter, and I was blown away by that. I thought it was just an extraordinary world. And the Othello was brilliant. And I remember having an experience, which I think many people have spoken about. In fact, I've read that it's a phenomenon. Along with the line that kills in Twelfth Night, I was adored once too. Apparently, several people have died in the playhouse.
Really?
When that line has been
spoken. That's fascinating. Yeah.
And the Othello sort of similar story is that people jump on stage and try and stop it happening. And I remember having that feeling of what it was kind of almost a panic. I wanted to get up on stage and tell Othello that he was mistaken. And so that was my, as a sort of, just as an audience member, first experience of Shakespeare really working.
So from that initial kind of connection with Othello, how has your relationship with Shakespeare changed over that time, would you say?
Well, it's funny, isn't it? I certainly went through a period where I quite wanted to not be obsessed with Shakespeare. And I decided that I preferred Webster, or I'd sort of get into Middleton. Partly as just a sort of bloody-minded desire to be a bit different, I think. And I suppose the thing with Shakespeare is that whenever I have rehearsed one of his plays, or read one of his plays, or occasionally even go and see a half-decent production of one of his plays, I'm drawn back to them just with that sort of slightly grumpy feeling that whoever he was, whatever he means, it's just, it's really good stuff. And that sort of feeling, I strongly believe that you can't tell what a playwright thinks by reading a play, or certainly not by reading a particular speech.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's foolish, whichever side, whichever political perspective you want to try and commandeer. Because, of course, it's the character saying it, and the characters are often lying or being ironic or manipulative. But nonetheless, having said that, I still feel, as I do with some other writers like James Joyce, a sort of decent humanity lurking around that I find attractive and charming and want to spend time with.
Yes, that's interesting. So even despite your sort of intellectual resistance to connecting with the writer beyond the text, you still find yourself coming back to that sometimes.
A feeling that I'm being held, even in some of the nasty, even, I mean, actually one of my favourite places is Troilus and Cressida, which of course is the most kind of sonnety, perhaps, and nasty of them. But even then, I still find myself moved by Cressida's plight, and I feel that somehow the playwright is also disposed that way in a way that I don't with the sleazy, sweaty boys of the Jacobean era. I just, there's a different feeling.
Yes, yeah. So let's come on to your sort of professional time with Shakespeare then. After acting, you moved into teaching actors. Many listeners will have no idea what goes on in drama school. So I wonder if you could just explain sort of briefly what your role as a voice tutor is, and particularly how that applies to developing actors with Shakespeare.
For some reason, the teaching of Shakespeare in drama schools fell somewhere between the voice and acting departments. And perhaps because the great teachers of voice in the 20th century had an incredible commitment and love for Shakespeare, from Elsie Fogarty onwards to teachers like Cicely Berry and Patsy Rodenberg, who's just resigned from the Guildhall, talking about this stuff. It's also sort of the most interesting material to work with, and the most interesting stuff that we do. So as a voice teacher, you're often working on a very fundamental level with people's bodies and breath and voice and sound. And to help somebody change profoundly, there is an awful lot of repetition and what I think the French call insiste. You have to insist on things over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's wonderful work because it helps people to change. And watching people change is a joy of teaching. But it's also an awful lot of rolling through your spine, humming, and practicing tongue twisters. So the bit when that work then moves into working on a piece of text, especially a piece of heightened, extraordinary text, is often the most delightful part of the day. So I think a combination of historical accident, inclination, curiosity, things being just the way they are, and some sort of feeling that in order to really live inside those texts, you need to have a certain technical facility, which I'm not sure I entirely agree with, but that's the sort of historical story.
Yeah. Is there, would you say, there's a RADA voice? Can you tell when you hear an actor where they've been trained, or it's more various than that?
I can tell. I play a game where I watch a movie or I go to the theatre, and if I'm with my wife, I'll often say, I think they went to wherever, and I'm quite often right. But no, I don't think, I think the RADA voice, there may have been, and I don't think there's been a RADA voice for a long time. I think I started teaching at RADA in 2006, something like that.
Mm.
And the voice department at that point was entirely sane and balanced and had sort of kept up with the development of contemporary sociolinguistics and didn't think that any one accent was better than any other accent and didn't make students change their accents at all. So certainly from that period onwards, definitely not, I would say.
And what little sort of verbal mannerisms do you pick up on when you think you know where an actor has gone to drama school? Is it pronunciation of words or just the way they shape a sentence?
So, for instance, if the schools that are a little bit more conservative is probably the wrong word, but particular about speech, I'll hear the end consonant that arrives a beat after the word as a sort of stuck-on effect. So there is a kind of hyper-articulacy that I associate with certain schools, not actually RADA or Lambda. Not that it's a bad idea to be clear, but it's when I feel like I can hear that the imagination is disconnected from the act of speaking. I hear technique, actually. And not in all students from those schools. I don't think I'll say which schools I think those are. I haven't said that already. So that's something. But often what I see is more an approach to acting or something in the body is why I can sometimes spot things. It's not often that much about language, actually.
Interesting. So to come to the key question, what, and I'm not asking you to give away all the secrets of your trade here, but what for you makes a really good speaker of Shakespeare? What is it that you're listening for in an actor who can speak Shakespeare well, whatever that means to you?
Whatever that means, yeah. I mean, I think it depends hugely on the individual, actually. I mean, essentially for me, it's about meaning. It's actually about understanding what's going on. Because meaning, imagination is what we're after. Imagination is what people want from their art, I think. But I realised a number of years ago that if you kind of had a metaphorical coin and you wrote imagination on one side and you flipped it over, it might say meaning. I don't think there's much difference between those two things. There's an almost completely forgotten teacher of acting who was actually an academic and then was brought into various drama schools, I think 50s into early 60s, and then went to the States. His name is Bertram Joseph, and he wrote some wonderful books on acting Shakespeare that are almost completely forgotten. And in the introduction to one, he says that the chief skill of the classical actor is being able to identify and observe in themselves when they don't understand what's going on. And it's something I always tell students I work with, because I think, especially young actors or inexperienced actors, feel a sense of shame when they don't understand something and either pretend they understand it or don't ask a question. And I've always tried to make it almost my primary goal to say, if you don't understand something, that's a gift. That's an indication of how good you are acting. Because it's the great actor that says, I haven't got a clue what's going on here, or what's this about? I worked with a great Beckett actor called Johnny Murphy, who was a star of the Irish stage. And we worked on the production of King Lear. And he was playing the fool. And all the way through rehearsals, all he would say is, I haven't got a clue what's going on. What does this mean? What's this play about? And by the time the show went up, he was the best thing in it. And he was just so comfortable saying, I don't understand this. And as a young actor playing Edgar, I would sort of pretend to know what was going on. So yeah, meaning, stroke imagination, actually.
So that's a figure from the teaching side. Are there actors or perhaps directors that you think, you know, working at the moment, that you think are particularly skilled or talented at speaking Shakespeare? Is anybody that particularly you look to and think, yes, that's how you do it?
No, because I think if you observe actors carefully, you see that they have different types of facility. So another sort of a reasonable observation is that to speak Shakespeare well, you have to have a jazz-like facility for language. And actually, some teachers try and teach that jazz-like facility for language. I don't think it's teachable. I think some people can really do that. Perhaps they, like most things, it's useful to practice it. And then that absolutely will come alive in a playhouse. It's delightful to watch somebody who has that gift. But it isn't the only valid gift. Who I loved doing Shakespeare, and this is probably just too ancient to be a useful reference, was Bob Hoskins. I remember watching his Iago, for instance, and just thinking it was extraordinary because he had the gift for being inside an evolving thought. So he spoke Shakespeare, and I don't think he was affected, it was just because he was a very fine actor. But for him, it was all about Iago working out what he was going to do. So he was absolutely in the present moment. That's a gift. And that's a gift which is slightly different, perhaps, from that sort of extraordinary facility with language and rhythm. Some people have a huge emotional connection. Some people have a wonderful voice, which contains multitudes of colours. But I like all sorts of different things. And my favourite Shakespeare in recent years, I have to say, has been not in English. I've enjoyed the Germans doing Richard III and the Japanese doing Macbeth. I liked Robert Lepage's Shakespeare when I was younger. I've seen very few productions of Shakespeare in English, produced by English companies, that I've enjoyed much. I don't think we're very good at Shakespeare.
Is that when you enjoy watching something in a Shakespeare in a different language, Is that because you feel a bit sort of freed from the expectations of it being in English? Do you think that it's that you're able to concentrate more on the story, that the language isn't kind of getting in the way, and perhaps it might do in an English version where you know it so well, or is it something else that
attracts you? I think so. I don't know. I feel like maybe they're freed, but I feel that certainly with, say, Ninagawa and Ostermeyer, I think they're getting at the play in a much more profound way than most productions I've seen. That may also be about a theatre culture and time to rehearse and just people being kind of intellectual giants. I don't know why.
So, Robert, you've agreed that we can have a look at a bit of Shakespeare practically now. So I'm going to submit myself to be your tutee for a few minutes.
Okay.
And we're going to look at the chorus opening speech of Henry V. So how should we approach this, Robert?
Do a bit. So let's see what you got.
Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention, a kingdom for a stage, princes to act, and monarchs to behold the swelling scene. Then should the warlike Harry, like himself, assume the port of Mars, and at his heels, leashed in like hounds, should famine, sword, and fire crouch for employment.
That's probably enough, is it?
Yeah.
A good bit. Yeah, I think, so my observations would say, if you were my student, I would say, you clearly got a facility for language, and you understand the speech, and that was wonderful. And maybe, so my two thoughts would be, firstly, you kind of started without thinking. So you went into it without any reason to start speaking, apart from the fact that you were starting speaking for the purpose of this podcast. So I would ask you, why do they speak? They're asking for a muse of fire. For what? That's a real question.
Because they look around them and they realise that it's such a kind of rubbish environment.
Yes.
And yet they're expecting all these people who've turned up and paid their money to believe for the next couple of hours that this is all the real deal.
Yes.
And the actor, you know, the actor looks around them and realises what a paltry business this is.
Yes. Perhaps. Yeah, no, that feels correct to me. That feels like a... But then, of course, as an individual, there will be different ways to respond to that. So I can imagine a certain human being amused by the mediocrity of or the hopelessness of theatre. Mm. It is quite funny. I mean, actors still find theatre funny.
It's absurd.
Yeah, exactly. It's absurd. And it's rather charming about actors that they are comfortable with the absurdity more than some other kinds of artists, actually. Mm. I don't think dancers tend to talk about the absurdity of dance, or singers talk about the absurdity of the opera. Mm. It's something charming about actors. So, but that's just a suggestion. So I would say that your James's response to the absurd nature of theatre would be something to find. And then as you move into the text, it sounded to me that it had the kind of melody that you use when you're doing your podcast, which is ever so slightly ironic. And although that irony, maybe that is necessary. Maybe that's how you approach this text. So I'd say either make the irony a choice that's emerging from the circumstance and what James the chorus is like, or we could find another choice. But at the moment, it's just a kind of habit of speech. So first of all, let's see if you can find the feeling of absurdity. Yeah. And then let's see what happens to the text.
Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention, a kingdom for a stage, princes to act and monarchs to behold the swelling scene. Then should the warlike Harry, like himself, assume the port of Mars, and at his heels, leashed in like hounds, should famine, sword, and fire crouch for employment.
Yeah, that was great. And you know that little mistake he made?
Mm.
We would celebrate that in a training.
Right.
Because there's something very interesting when somebody is highly competent and really knows a text. When they make a fumble, that's cause for a party, because it indicates that something is shifting.
There's something live.
There's something live. Yes. They're not simply replicating or repeating. It's not a photocopy of an act of memory or imagination 10 years ago. So that was great. And then the next thing I would suggest, I wouldn't work like this if we were working, I'd give you more time, but seeing as we're on a podcast, is to think about what you're doing, so what's happening, and there are certain kinds of speeches that are quite tricky to analyse from an acting point of view. The Russians will say that in a sense the play stops because there's no real conflict. So the principle of drama, of course, is that I want something from you and you want something from me, and we battle it out. There are certain speeches of Shakespeare's, I always think about that Mercutio speech, where I'm not sure really that's happening. It sort of is an aria.
The Queen Mab.
Queen Mab speech. Yeah, the Queen Mab speech. Yes. And I played Mercutio once, and I was terrible. And I can remember being in the middle of that speech thinking, I don't know what it's for.
Yeah.
And then I worked with a Russian director called Anatoly Vasilyev, who was actually talking about Chekhov, and said that in Chekhov, some of the speeches in Chekhov, like Dr. Astrov's speech, are also unactable. Though he would say, the play has stopped. You cannot act it using proper Stanislavski techniques. You have to find a different device. If that isn't true for this, so if this is kind of actable, if it is active, then that would mean that you're trying to change an audience member from one thing into another. So I wonder if this speech is... We can work it out that way. What are you doing? So you're feeling the absurdity of the situation.
Mm.
You've dealt with that. We're exploring the possibility that you might deal with that ironically. But what are you doing to me, I suppose?
Well, I'm trying to recruit you into this imaginary setup I'm about to go into, but pardon, gentles all, I'm about to address you directly.
Yes.
And ask you to give me something.
Yes.
The conflict here, I suppose, is that I want you to lend me your imagination.
Yes.
For the next couple of hours, I need to
persuade
you to do that, despite all the material reasons behind me why you wouldn't engage with that.
And that's interesting, isn't it? So if you intuit that I'm sceptical, and I must be hard to get because otherwise there's no conflict, there's no obstacle, there's no point in talking. So the difficulty is part of the point. Then maybe your irony is kind of somewhere in the region of charm or flirtation, which will then become clear when you get to the bit that we're not going to get to. So that would you want to try that? Should we put your choice into action, as it were?
Yeah. Okay. Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention, a kingdom for a stage, princes to act, and monarchs to behold the swelling scene. Then should the warlike Harry, like himself, assume the port of Mars, and at his heels, leashed in like hounds, should famine, sword, and fire crouch for employment. But pardon, gentles all, the flat unraised spirits that hath dared on this unworthy scaffold to bring forth so great an object.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No.
But I was quite enjoying that. That was sort of becoming something more alive. The next thought I would have, I would be quite happy to leave that idea. I think we have an idea to explore. Yeah. And then I would probably work with you quite technically on giving time for breath to drop in. So you have a lovely voice, James, and a considerable facility with language. But I think your sound is kind of almost sounds better than it's well produced. So just a little bit more time for the body to actually support. So now I would get quite technical, I think, with you.
Great. We need to start wrapping up, and
yes.
I would quite happily spend the rest of the day working on that speech with you. It's been fascinating. Thank you for that. One final question. Imagine that somebody is lucky enough to have a theatre budget for the next 12 months or so, £100. How would you suggest they spend it? You've already suggested that maybe British theatre is not quite so worth their money, although there might be a production coming up that you think would be. Should they get the cheapest ticket they can to Germany and go and see some Shakespeare in in Germany.
Well, they can see some Ibsen in the Duke of York's theatre at the moment. So Thomas Ostermeyer has directed an English cast for the first time in a production of Enemy of the People. And I think that production is good theatre. I don't think it's necessarily great theatre, but it's good theatre. And I watched it in a £40 seat, and I would quite happily have watched it in a slightly better one. So I might advise taking your money and splashing it on a bit of Ostermeyer at the Duke of York's.
Yeah, and Shakespeare, a Shakespeare production in particular, is there
one coming up?
Excited about?
I do love The Duchess of Malfi, and I've seen many, not Shakespeare, obviously.
Indeed. I'm close enough for the purposes of the podcast.
Yes, if we can sort of broaden it out a little bit. And I've seen it many, many times, and I'm always curious to see productions. There's a production at the Wanamaker. I saw the famous or infamous, what's her name?
Gemma Arterton, 10 years ago. Exactly.
10 years ago, which I didn't think was great, to be honest. So I think I'd go and see Ibsen and Webster.
Yeah.
I can't think of a Shakespeare off the top of my head.
Mm. Interesting. Great. Robert Price, thank you very much.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, James.
Thank you.
So there you have it. A few against-the-grain opinions about our handling of Shakespeare, but also an irresistible affection for his work from a man with a rare vantage point. I should have pressed him a bit further on the claim that we in Britain are not very good at Shakespeare. I, for one, am hoping that my ticket to Ian McKellen and Robert Icke's 4-hour Play of Kings later this summer will be counter-evidence to that. Time will tell, I suppose. My thanks again to Robert Price for his time and good humour. I hope to do more interviews with the experienced and the expert as a way of keeping the podcast going once I've finished all the plays. So if you're in that category and we've ever met, be ready. Thank you for listening, and farewell.